Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Alva.
I'm Anoush.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. On today's episode, we discuss Robert Jenrick's cladding proposals. And you ask us, why aren't the Lib Dems doing better than the Greens? So yesterday, Robert Jenrick announced his much anticipated plans for resolving the ongoing cladding problem with unsafe cladding on lots of buildings around the UK. He had a package of just over £3 billion for buildings over 18 metres in England. Anoush, you wrote a great analysis of this yesterday, sort of what this quite limited thing does and doesn't do. Would you mind sort of running through the big problems with it and also the good things if you want to start on a positive note?
Yeah, well, it is a good thing that they're releasing more funding for this, because it is a widespread problem. Essentially, for those who haven't been following the ins and outs of it, people who are living in buildings that are wrapped in the similar type of dangerous cladding that the Grenfell Tower had when it was refurbished are in sort of a difficult position where they are having to have their buildings remediated to take away the fire unsafe stuff, and leaseholders are having to pay for those costs as well as the other costs that come around these kind of changes. So whether that's insurance, service charge on your building, or, you know, other fire safety things like having to have a waking watch if you're living in a building that's unsafe. So while the government has been taking cladding off social housing buildings and other above 18 high rises since the Grenfell Tower fire, the estimates are that there's millions of other people who are trapped in private buildings being hit with these huge costs. And there's already been bankruptcies of people stuck in this situation. Obviously, you can't remortgage your house because mortgage lenders aren't giving mortgages on these flats anymore. And also, you can't sell it either, because who's going to buy that? And this sort of seems to be falling on the shoulders of leaseholders in blocks of flats, many of whom are on shared ownership schemes or have got their first property through Help to Buy, for example. Or sometimes it's people who want to retire and move, and they've found themselves stuck in flats that they can't sell and that are too expensive for them to live in. So it's a really horrible situation for a lot of people. And the government so far hasn't really taken it particularly seriously. There was £1.6 billion made available last year, which was nowhere near enough. Robert Jenrick yesterday announced £3.5 billion, but again, this was only for buildings over 18 metres in England. And the reason for that is because the over 18 metre blocks are thought to be the ones that are most dangerous. Nevertheless, there's a great many other blocks that are lower than that, and also the over 18 metre and under 18 metre blocks in the other devolved nations that aren't getting this funding. Instead, in England, there's going to be a loan system for those in lower blocks, but there's no suggestion of how long you'd have to pay these loan repayments, only that there would be no more than £50 a month. But why, most people are asking, do leaseholders have to pay anything at all for something that is just not at all their fault? When you buy a flat, you don't expect that it's been built to unsafe standards. So it's the fault of government regulation, and it's also the fault of the people who build these buildings, as is coming out of the Grenfell Tower inquiry that's ongoing at the moment that we've discussed before in the podcast. So The problem is that Robert Jenrick's funding doesn't go far enough. The remit or the eligibility of the funding isn't broad enough. But also, he only spoke about the removal of unsafe cladding. There's so many other problems that people are having to shoulder the costs to fix. So whether that's, you know, the insulation materials, lots of the problems that happened at Grenfell were from the insulation materials and how they'd been used in the building. Again, the fire warden costs for running these waking watches while you wait for the work to be done to try and keep you safe. Fire alarm systems, wooden balconies, cavity barriers, all of these other problems he didn't mention. So it seems to be quite a narrow remit. And it hasn't just been, you know, whiny lefty journalists like me complaining that his policies don't go far enough. There is a building Tory rebellion basically gathering around this amendment that two Tory MPs have proposed for the fire safety bill, saying that no cost should fall on leaseholders who are living in these buildings. And I'm sure Stephen can fill us in more about the politics behind this.
Yeah, so the politics of it are just sort of astonishingly crazy, right? Because so in May 2018, which I mean was scandalously late enough anyway, the government accepted not only the local authority and housing association maintained blocks of flats would have their cladding removed, but the central government would pay for it. But of course, like, it is plainly ridiculous for all the reasons you've just set out, Anoush, to suggest that it is the responsibility of the tenant or the leaseholder to have to pay for a failure of regulation, right? Robert Jenrick's argument is akin to saying that, not akin to, his explicit argument rests on the idea that if you go to DFS, you buy a sofa, unless you literally got a thing of matches, lit them and threw them at the sofa before buying them to check when they didn't ignite, you do not have a reasonable expectation that your sofa is fire safe, right? Like, that is his argument, right?
Or like you only do if your sofa is of a certain size.
Yeah, and then the thing, and
3-seater, yes, we'll pay you back. 2-seater, sorry, no can do.
And this is the thing is that the argument was, you know, I think morally and intellectually bankrupt when it was all blocks of flats, right? But the political craziness. As you know, one of the Conservative MPs who've been campaigning on this for a really long time, they just said, honestly, the only way that the government position makes sense to me politically is if someone's gone, wow, it was pretty shameful and it took till May of 2018 for us to do this. Maybe we should keep delaying it so we eventually do pay the deserved political price. Because once you've conceded the point correctly that it's not reasonable for... Like, this is the thing, it would obviously not be reasonable for me to have to pay for the removal of dangerous cladding from blocks like mine, which are local authorities. And really, I mean, thank goodness to NS podcast listeners, then they have made that decision, because otherwise every week of the podcast would be cladding week. But once you've conceded that point for a local authority maintained block and a housing association block, there is literally no argument that changes if you are a privately owned block. And the argument becomes even crazier if it's 18 metres and 6 stories. Well, at the 7th story, that's the point when leaseholders suddenly lose their powers of omniscience. They're like, I sense fire danger. Like that can't be the case. And the thing is, the reason why this has now become particularly politically, I mean, one is that the people who were informed about it first, yeah, have been a very well-organised campaign, very helpful, done all the, yeah, the kind of stuff to get people engaged. But the reason why it's made becoming particularly acute and painful in the Conservative Party is broadly the swing and Conservative voters are like the last group of people left now. Now, I'm not saying that, obviously, like, there are loads of people who are committed Labour, committed Green, committed Lib Dem voters who live in, you know, in nice private blocks of flats. And indeed, you know, it's not like my block of flats is not a very nice block. But broadly, like, if you have been a beneficiary of Conservative housing policies, you are quite likely to live in one of these blocks. A lot of marginal seats have got, like, at least one or two blocks and meet this description. And they are an electorally non-trivial number of people. And to make matters worse, one MP put this really well to me when they kind of said, the thing the Tory government has not got, but Tory MPs have started to understand, is it's not just, oh, you know, yeah, a young woman gets a help to buy mortgage when her, like, grandmother dies and they sell off the flat and she, like, lives in her, like, nice private block somewhere in Manchester or London or whatever. And if she's in London, she maybe lives in one of the marginal seats and the Conservatives do still hold in London. But it's then when she goes back home to the West Midlands or another part of the country with more marginal seats, everyone goes, oh, have you heard that our Shell is still massively in debt because of Grenfell and the government is refusing to pay? That one of the political problems is that it's starting, I'm told by Conservative MPs, it's starting to seep into not just the mailbags of MPs with marginal seats in cities who, there's this kind of weird problem where the Conservative Party has developed London blindness, right? It just cannot see its 21 London MPs, which is weird when you consider that one of them is the Prime Minister. But they've just kind of started like, well, what would happen if we lost 21 seats at the next election? We wouldn't be able to govern. We can barely do that now. I think what started to happen is then the political consequences of the fact that a lot of people who are integral to the Conservative Party's ability to govern have kids who are directly affected by this scandal, have friends who are directly affected by this scandal. And the political staff now, right? Because it would obviously not be defensible if they'd gone just palm the cost off on local authorities. But it would not be as politically painful as the position they're now in. And I think the central thing is that there's a large chunk of the government which broadly has this kind of incredibly sort of retrograde attitude about who lives in tower blocks, is almost trying to govern an electorate that doesn't exist, and basically thinks, yeah, as indeed like some common left-wing commentary on this goes, oh, the reason why this is happening is people have contempt for the poor. It's like, well, in the nicest possible way, if you live in one of the like lovely posh cladded blocks around here and you're an owner-occupier, you're being made poor by government policy, but you certainly weren't poor to begin with. And I think the political reason why this is acute is that your average Conservative MP does understand that this is their problem, but the government has this kind of attitude and like, oh, we're not for these people. We're basically for the people who've made the towers. Mm. And what we're going to start seeing is the collision between that imagined electoral coalition and that real electoral coalition.
I think it's also worth thinking about the scale of this as well, because if the plan was just to focus on buildings that were over 18 meters first, I think like to that extent the prioritization of those blocks makes sense, because clearly, I mean, I suppose it depends on the exact buildings, but in general it's more difficult to escape from a very tall building in a fire than a less tall building, so it kind of makes sense to prioritize those buildings. But like the divide between buildings that are over 18 meters high in England where the government will replace the cladding, and buildings between 11 meters and 18 meters where you'll have to take out this loan is huge, in that buildings over 18 meters high, there are estimated to only be about 10,000 of them in the UK, which is obviously still quite a lot. But when you include then buildings over 11 meters, that according to Inside Housing, these are their figures, then it jumps up to 100,000 buildings. So even though like you're really talking about just a tiny fraction of the buildings that are affected by this, and it's just a tiny fraction of the people who live in these unsafe buildings are actually going to be having their cladding replaced by the government, and everyone else is like really the majority of people are in the situation where they're taking on this loan. So I suppose the way the policy is framed, I think the question of scale is slightly elided, because you just think, oh, that's great, they're sorting out the big tower blocks. But in terms of the numbers of people, like you were saying, Stephen, the numbers of voters affected by this, it's many, many, many more people who are facing bankruptcy, or, you know, the financial impact of that extra, you know, the government has said that the loans would be capped at £50 per month. But I think like an additional cost of £50 per month, probably indefinitely, because there's unsafe cladding on your property. And that's not even including all the other costs that Anoush was talking about. That's still a huge financial impediment that people shouldn't have to personally shoulder, who had like no way of knowing when they bought those properties that they weren't like fit for human habitation, that they like weren't fire safe. So just I think the scale of that problem is huge. It's a bit like at school when they sort of explain the relative societal harm of alcohol versus drugs, I think, in that clearly on an individual level, like one person taking heroin is at more risk than someone drinking a beer. And I suppose the equivalent is like one person in a very tall building with unsafe cladding is at more risk than another person in a less tall building with unsafe cladding. But then on a society-wide level, the harm done by illegal drugs versus the harm done by alcohol consumption in the round is like it's much, much higher, the societal harm of alcohol, just because it's much more widespread, rather than the tiny numbers of people taking illegal drugs, relatively speaking. And it's just sort of the same thing, where the way the scale isn't being properly taken into consideration means that even if you think, as I'm sure Robert Jenrick seems to, that, you know, this is based on a really thorough risk assessment, if you think you're sort of resolving the riskiest cases, you're not really resolving the main source of the risk, which is many, many, many more people living in like fire unsafe homes who aren't getting the government support. But also, like, I think that point that you made, Anoush, about all of the other costs, because I mentioned this issue in Morning Call this morning, and we had loads of replies from people who live in places that have sort of fire safety issues that aren't to do with cladding. I was saying this to Stephen the other day, and then I kind of realized I don't even really know about it, but I think I also live in a building that doesn't have a cladding issue, but has that doesn't have fire safe insulation. And it probably doesn't affect me personally because I rent, but for the people, like for our neighbors who own their flats, it's a huge worry. And, you know, there are like residents meetings over Zoom every week to talk about it. But we had loads of replies from lots of people in that situation, people who, like, we had one email from someone who I like know personally, who's in his 30s, and he's got a bill of £20,000 to fix fire safety issues in his building. It isn't cladding, it's to do with cavity barriers. And their building is just 1 meter under the magical 18 meters. And I just think that when you take into account not just the kind of the height of the buildings, but the all of the other fire safety issues, it's really like, it's a good headline, I suppose, to change the cladding on tall buildings over a certain height. But it doesn't really address any of the concerns in the round.
Yeah, that's really interesting about all of the responses that you got to the email. And it does chime with what Stephen says about how sort of you may know someone who knows someone, and that's going to get more and more widespread as more and more people realise that they're being hit with these costs. And of course, a good headline figure for a narrow number of buildings is not going to have an impact in real life to stop that happening and seeping into MPs' mailbags and pervading the general consciousness of homeowners and leaseholders, and also people who are renting as well will be aware of issues like this happening in their building, and they may well have to pay higher service charges, for example. So it probably will affect, you know, a big, big, significant chunk of people who live in flats across the country. And like Stephen says, the politics of that are going to become more and more challenging for the government. There's already a Daily Mail campaign to end the cladding scandal. And I think that says quite a lot. Also, the more the government leaves it without the adequate amount of help, the more political capital it loses on this issue, because already people have been hit with these costs, already people are in debt, already people have been made bankrupt by this. And that's not going to change. That's just going to increase until they actually take it seriously. Delaying it, I don't think, will help them. I mean, they're due up for cross-examination at the Grenfell inquiry at the end of this year, I think. And so, you know, that if there's going to be more and more scandals coming out about this that coincides with probably what's going to be quite an embarrassing cross-examination at the end of the year, then that could really put Grenfell and its legacy into the spotlight, particularly if the pandemic has somehow abated or is a little more under control by then because of that the vaccination drive. So they're not going to have very much to hide behind. I mean, let's not forget that the UK actually lifted its ban on combustible insulation for high rises in 2006. So, you know, and then since then, as has been shown by the inquiry, and I won't go into the details, but it's been a matter of sort of interpretation of buildings regulations. And some builders had been begging for there to be more clarity on it because they're just quite grey and they can be interpreted in different ways. Arconic, which is the manufacturer of the cladding that was on Grenfell Tower, they were focusing on countries where national regulations are not as restrictive, in inverted commas, and one of those countries was the UK. So I don't think that the government is going to come out well from the inquiry. And if this cladding crisis has built up to more of a crescendo by then, by the time that they're in front of the inquiry, it could be massively damaging for them. So I don't really know, particularly not with the amount of opposition on their own backbenches, why they haven't chosen to look this problem in the eye.
It's also, I suppose, in conflict with a lot of the political values that the Conservatives would be hoping to align themselves with in terms of wanting to be the party of home ownership, the party of people who get on. And I think that the kinds of stories around private flat owners and so on, I think are particularly uncomfortable for the Conservatives' political interests and are in particular conflict with a kind of conservative sense of justice and people's, you know, right to get what they pay for and for, you know, for their, you know, to not sort of be screwed over by things. I think it's the particular stories. There was a really moving one yesterday. I mean, there's that prominent one that you mentioned, Anoush, that woman who went bankrupt after buying her own home. But there are plenty of others. There was this lawyer who bought her own home, who lives in a building with unsafe cladding that's below 18 meters, and who is really worried that with the costs of not just the £50 a month to replace the cladding, but I think there are other fire safety issues that they're paying the costs of. The insurance is very, very high, and they have to pay for a fire warden 24/7. It's a huge amount of money. She's really, really worried that she's going to go bankrupt. So not only would she lose her home, she would also lose her job, because as a lawyer, she wouldn't be able to practice if she had gone bankrupt. Mm. And I think that's a heartbreaking story for everyone. But it's obviously a difficult story for the Conservatives to be seen not to be addressing, to not be on the side of homeowners who have got savings together and bought their first home. And, you know, I think there's an obviously politically tricky angle to it, that it's confusing to me in a way that the political difficulty of this isn't more apparent to Robert Jenrick and co. But also I think the thing is that it isn't just these stories of injustice and more scandals around the financial and psychological burden, but it's also the grimmer thing that as time goes on, it's just surely likely that one of these buildings where these problems are not being adequately addressed will result in a horrible story about a fire. I think that would be the concern. You know, it's like people's real safety as well as the financial side of things.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So this is a question from Vera in London, who asks, why do the Lib Dems keep polling behind environmentalists who don't like trains? Stephen, you have been writing a bit within the past week about various parties' performances in the polls and also the impact of the Green vote. So how would you answer this question? Why do Lib Dems keep polling behind environmentalists who don't like trains?
I'm glad that we've decided to repeat the exact wording of the question twice, just to like really annoy all of our Green activists listening. I mean, also, actually, it's worth noting that there is within the Green Party a sizable group called Greens for High Speed 2, who I think make a lot of really good arguments and are massively unfairly slagged off by other parts of the party for suggesting they're in the pocket of big train. I mean, imagine being an activist in an environmental party and accusing people who are lobbying for more trains of being in the pocket of big train. I mean, it's just like, Some people, honestly. But so a lot of people got, I would say, overly excited about one poll this week, which was one showing the Greens on their highest level since August 2019. But in many ways, that was the more important thing was what was not new about that poll, which is the kind of Greens, sort of what you might think of peacetime level, like the level of support they get when people aren't feeling particularly election-y, seems to have reached a kind of new normal, right? So after about May 2019, it went up. It was continually bouncing around in the 4 to 8% zone, which obviously from a margin of error perspective, I basically somewhere in that zone, spiking a bit higher after the local elections, which is kind of what we'd expect when a minor party has as good a set of local elections as the Greens did in May 2019. And now, yeah, the more important story than the Greens being on 8% is that they are continually polling pretty healthily and occasionally polling ahead of the Liberal Democrats. The central thing is, right, is the people who are committed and concerned about this issue, and obviously I've talked about doing this myself in the past, right, people understand, I think, whether they understand it because they actually would articulate it like this, or they have broadly and correctly grasped this fairly obvious point, then if what you want to do is signal to the main parties that you are deeply concerned about the climate crisis, what is the obvious lever you pull, whether in local elections, in the polls, yada, yada, it's to say you're voting Green. And I think people do that with varying levels of awareness that that's what they're doing. But one thing I think polls in midterm tend to show is basically what people's expressive vote is rather than their effective vote. So at the moment, I think if I was rung up by a pollster, I probably would go like Green. And if I went don't know, I would be reallocated to how I voted in 2019, which would, of course, get me to Green anyway. So, but, you know, one way or the other, I would come out as Green. Now, in practice, because our local council, which will obviously be the next opportunity I get to vote at that level, has been very pro low traffic neighbourhoods, which I am fairly typically quite pro, I think it's unlikely that I wouldn't go, OK, I need to send the strongest signal that I am in favour of what the council is doing. But so I think that's one of the main reasons, right? Ultimately, like, the Greens are doing well for the same reason that UKIP were doing well, which is their central issue, the issue on which people care about, is in the news. We're lucky in this country to now be in a situation where it is broadly accepted by almost everyone in politics, and it is a problem. We now have a situation where, you know, The Sun and The Express are running Green campaigns. One party strategist said to me in 2019, you know, they said, yeah, the things you can't leave your campaign room without are a climate policy and a childcare policy, because voters aged 30 to 50 are broadly the swing vote doesn't really matter. They're the ones who are directly touched by childcare policies, and everyone in the country cares about the green issues. And you can see this actually, you know, if you look at who votes green in the polls. Now, just because they have the same social and attitudinal profile as the ones who are voting green under Corbyn, it's possible they're not actually the same people. But broadly, we're talking people across the age spectrum, a range of previous voting patterns, including for the Tory party. And I think then ultimately, just like, because they are the Green Party and people are concerned about green issues. I mean, I understand why it is that people in both the Labour and the Liberal Democrats will go, yeah, but they're not even for High Speed 2, or but we have a more sensible policy on nuclear or whatever. And I'm not saying those things are necessarily unreasonable, but I think it would be a mistake for the Liberal Democrats to believe that their approach to their undoubted green problem, because that electoral coalition looks a lot like the successful electoral coalition of the Liberal Democrats, would be to go, oh, actually, we're better at being green than them. The only way they would ever do that would be to travel back in time and to, like, pack the room so that the Green Party didn't rename itself from the Ecology Party in, like, the late 80s or early 90s. I forget when they was when they did that. But, yeah, that's why. They're seen as the most authentic way of going, I'm deeply concerned about what's happening to my biosphere.
Yeah, and I think what you said about the fact that campaign strategists can't leave the room without having a policy on climate change issues these days is a really good one. And it sort of ties into what I've been thinking about the Greens for a while now, which is that not only do you have the main two parties putting climate change quite high up their agenda, more so than ever before, but you also have just so many climate change, climate crisis stories, you know, from the protests that were happening a year ago, Extinction Rebellion, however you feel about them, they make headlines, David Attenborough documentaries that, you know, take more of a direct approach to referencing the impact on the planet than they ever have before. You have all sorts of things that are just sort of swimming around at the top of people's consciousness, coupled with the fact that the impact of climate policies on a local level are just so tangible. So low traffic neighbourhoods is one example. You have Sadiq Khan and TfL considering introducing a Greater London boundary charge for vehicles coming into London. So you have all of these kind of the impact of these kind of policies on the ground. So, you know, whether or not you're annoyed by some of them or you don't agree with some of them, it's very much in the public conversation, both on Facebook groups, but also in politicians' announcements and on TV. So kind of in the local news war and the national news war. It's everywhere. And I think that means that if you are answering pollsters' questions at the moment about which party you prefer, and you want to signal the fact that you're affected by this conversation and that you're interested in it and you're enthusiastic about it, then you were probably putting green considerations into your choice higher than you have been before. So that might result in choosing a different party, but it also means that you'll opt for green if you're opting to demonstrate your enthusiasm for environmental policies. So I think that's been helpful for the Greens. We actually did some polling with a polling company called Redfield and Wilton earlier this year in January. And the results for Sian Berry, who is their London mayoral candidate, were interesting. So she got 9% of first preference votes. That's 1% behind the Lib Dem candidate. And then for second prefs, she got 30%, which is, you know, I know that there was lots of excitement among sort of green enthusiasts in the office. And of course, all of Stephen's very well rehearsed caveats about just one poll apply. But I think it is interesting that you can see the local elections and the mayoral elections coming up as potentially a gauge of whether or not this kind of ambient green support that we're seeing can convert itself into actual votes come election time, because obviously we haven't had elections for a while. So that will be interesting to see. But also the fact that they are polling well in some of these polls will mean that there's more chatter about them going into these elections. And that's a help for the party in itself. You know, if the Lib Dems look a bit limp in some of these polls, perhaps there's not so much interest in them from sort of the national media, whereas there might be a number of stories where people go and focus on a council where the Greens potentially could do well. And the more that there's chatter about that, the more people will have heard about it when they go to the ballot box or they vote by post or whatever's going to happen this year. So I think it's a good time for them. And even if you can't extrapolate too much from individual polls, the mood music is good. And the mood music is an important motivator in itself.
Yeah. And I suppose another way of looking at the original question from Vera in London, who I imagine is a Lib Dem, if not member than voter, would be the way that that kind of encapsulates the challenge for the Lib Dems, in that like that question is clearly an expression of frustration that the Lib Dems are not seen as green a party as they see themselves, or as many Lib Dems would see themselves. And I suppose some of that is the insurmountable problem that, like, if you're not called the Green Party, you can't be more green than the Green Party. And also, as you were both saying, that's the most effective way of signalling your increasing prioritisation of green issues if you're a sort of regular voter. But it's also indicative of the challenge for the Lib Dems to reinvent themselves post-Brexit, I suppose, because when Ed Davey was elected as leader, when he delivered his virtual speech at a conference, which some people clearly are more used to having to deliver awkward speeches over Zoom, but it was uncomfortable viewing, just watching a speech to an empty room with tumbleweeds. He used that speech to try to relaunch the Lib Dems in a way post-Brexit as the party of A, social care, the party of carers, and, you know, Ed Davey is of course one himself, and then secondly the party of the climate crisis, which is something that he's really passionate about, and many if not most Lib Dems really, really are, and do have very considered positions on this. But it's just the challenge of kind of trying to do that, it was a success in a way of the Lib Dems to position themselves as such a clearly pro-European party and to really cut through with that branding, even if the revoke policy didn't really work for them. The pro-Remain policy did, particularly in the European elections. And I suppose now they're kind of trying to get over that and define themselves as the party of other things. And it's just really, really hard for them to do that when there isn't really much interest in the third party, you know, and, you know, possibly one day the fourth party, if the Greens continue to do better. There isn't really much space for them to signal that they are more interested in social care and climate change now than they were in recent years, that they've sort of shifted their focus. There's not really anywhere for them to make that case. And I suppose it's just going to take a long time. Maybe the problem of really defining yourself as a pro-European party for so long is that then when that becomes slightly less salient, it's hard to redefine yourself.
One of the sort of crucial differences is, well, it's basically who is the Green Party leader is a question with a correct answer than is also the wrong answer, because the correct answer is Sean Berry and Jonathan Bartley, or as Getty Images is desperate to believe, Jonathan Berry and Sean Bartley. But the actual answer in most folks' minds is Caroline Lucas, right? She is the most high profile and she's been around for a long time. She speaks very well. She's kind of people who people associate with the party. And although many Liberal Democrats criticised him at the time and felt he wasn't very effective, one of the major losses when Vince Cable stepped down is he was basically the last Liberal Democrat that anyone normal had heard of. And the party's resting average under Vince was higher than it was under Farron and higher than it was under Joe Swinson. And I think it's partly just the resting average stuff. I kind of think, I mean, it's odd. When Ed Davey gave that speech, I sent a tweet that loads of people interpreted as a pro-Keir one, which was one of the advantages Keir Starmer had. And one of the reasons why Keir Starmer had a good conference season in the mind of the lobby is Keir Starmer has a huge amount of experience at like giving speeches to empty rooms from his time at DPP, right? He's actually really well developed for the age of Zoom. Whereas Ed Davey, I think, in every way is actually a much better conference speaker than Keir Starmer. But actually, one of the reasons why his speech was so terrible is, I mean, like, it had pause for laughter. And it's like, why would you pause for laughter, Ed? Who do you think's going to laugh? The no one else in the room? Like,
it's also a bit like when you see a play or a musical filmed up close.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's just a bit too expressive.
Yeah.
When it's right there in your face, you need to be sort of hundreds and hundreds of meters away for that to work.
But the thing is just as, I'm not saying that I think that, you know, Keir Starmer will stink up the joint in his first proper conference speech. But just as when normal politics comes around, the fact that like Lib Dem activists will leave the hall feeling, you know, kind of perked up because Ed Davey will do the kind of like, you know, defense of liberalism, my time in fighting climate change, and they'll all feel a bit better. The thing that's slightly weird about politics at the moment, and the thing that I think will be very weird about the local elections, is because we're all stuck inside and there isn't therefore that much local politics than people feel and experience. This is going to be quite a national election, which will help in climate change's high salience, will therefore help the Greens in areas like Solihull, where they have a very good chance of being ahead of a rainbow coalition, and will help them in places like Liverpool, where they and the Lib Dems are kind of still in a tussle for who the second party is. And for various reasons, I think politics in Liverpool at the moment are well placed for a third party to do well. He said gently doing disclaimers around those issues. But I think once we have a return to, I don't mean normal politics as in, yeah, the things we'll be arguing about will be strange and unpredictable and deeply important as they always are. But once we get back to the era of normal politics, being able to point at potholes again, conference speeches in non-empty rooms. I do think some of the stuff for the Lib Dems will improve, not necessarily in terms of their poll share, but like when the dust settles, what really matters, I think, for the Greens isn't they can get into a position where seats where they could plausibly win. And although I think there's some way from this being the case in Solihull, I think Solihull is a place that they could replace the Liberal Democrats as the major Conservative challenger in a seat that the Lib Dems did hold for a long time. I think they could emerge as plausible challengers across Bristol. And those are really the challenges for the Green Party, because at the moment, we kind of know that what happens is a bunch of people go, yeah, I love the Green Party. And then the general election happens. And in different ways, both Labour and the Liberal Democrats can, and indeed the Conservatives can use the hammer of, well, they're nice, but they can't win round here. And did we mention we have an environmental policy too?
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, and my colleagues Stephen Bush and Anusha Kellyan. You can find me on Twitter @pronouncedalva.
You can find me on Twitter at @Anoush_C.
And you can find me on Twitter as @StephenKB.
We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening, and if you've enjoyed this, please rate and review, and don't forget to subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.